I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Secretary of State Colin Powell in Phuket, Thailand today said some 4,000 Americans are still unaccounted for in the aftermath of the tsunami.
I don't even know if they should be called missing. We're just trying to track them down.
Powell also said the U.S. may be able to do more to help identify the approximately 140,000 who are dead. Meanwhile, the government of Indonesia estimates that because of the earthquake and tsunami, 35,000 children have been made homeless, orphaned, or separated from their parents in the province of Aceh alone, and stories of child kidnapping and improper adoptions are starting to surface in Aceh and in Thailand, where a 12-year-old Swedish boy who survived the tsunami may have been kidnapped from a hospital by a European man. Around the world, more than 1 million children are trafficked each year, one-third of them in the region where the tsunami struck. Joining us on the line is John Budd. He's spokesperson for UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund, and he joins us on a very shaky line from Jakarta, Indonesia. Our apologies. But, John, what are you seeing in Indonesia? Give us a broad view of the situation facing children where you are.
It remains extremely vulnerable situation for children in two respects. The first one is that the situation concerning their food and indeed their medical situation in some areas of Aceh still remains extremely hard, to say the least. There are increasing concerns about sanitation, but another issue has emerged, and that is an issue to do with protecting children from exploitation. In particular, we have beginning to get quite serious evidence of organized gangs operating there to seize children for adoption overseas.
We understand there's been at least one confirmed case of a child seized in the Aceh region.
Yes, the police in Medan, which is a city just to the south of the disaster zone, a very big city, a provincial city renowned in Indonesia for trafficking children for adoption and also for sexual exploitation. The police arrested a couple there for trafficking a child. So that is one specific piece of evidence that you do have. But if I may, I'd like to read out this to you. This was received as a text message on a mobile that one of my colleagues in Malaysia, in Kuala Lumpur, received yesterday. It says 300 orphans, age 3 to 10 years, from Aceh for adoption. All paperwork will be taken care of, no fee. Please state age and sex of child required. And then it gives a name and a telephone number.
Oh. Have you called that person? Has UNICEF taken it upon themselves to track down the source of that? Is that something you're going to turn over to authorities?
We've turned it over to authorities.
Right.
And we've heard of this in other areas as well, by the way.
Yeah. And, of course, the worst thought of all is that these might not be adoptive parents. These might be people who would want these children for sexual purposes.
Well, I think you could fairly say there's going to be two categories. I mean, you know, essentially what you're going to see are younger children, probably aged up to 10, who will go to adoption. There's no doubt about that. And then there are the adolescent children, particularly girls, who will be trafficked into the sex industry. And that in Indonesia is a considerable problem for UNICEF before the tsunami struck in all parts of Indonesia. So we are alarmed now in Aceh because the infrastructure that would normally support children is destroyed. I mean, in just three districts, we've lost nearly 700 teachers. UNICEF today has set up what we call a child-friendly space. Now, what that means is that we set up basically a shelter, if you like, in which we staff. And the staff there do three things. Firstly, to help them overcome enormous psychological problems that they face. Then we have a tracing, monitoring, and registering system. And then we do the very simple thing. We provide a space and equipment and gear for children to play. So these areas are designed to start the process of returning a child to normality. And we set up one today. We'll have another four by the end of the week. So there'll be five by the end of the week. And over the next 2 weeks, we'll have a total of 20. Now, that is our first response. Our second response is that we have distributed right throughout all the camps here where there are people sheltering. We have putting in distributing registration papers in which we can register the children so we know who they are. And the final thing we're trying to do is that hopefully sometime in early February with the government, we'll support the government in getting children back to school. And we've got 600 temporary schools on the way into Aceh, which can basically provide an education facility for 60,000 children. Now, they will then form the basis of an ability to be able to monitor what children will do. So that is what UNICEF is doing immediately. We're also working very closely with the government in order to get the authorities themselves to stop children being trafficked out of the area.
Well, John, we know that Indonesia, as you said, has banned adoptions and unaccompanied child travel in Aceh. Sri Lanka has condemned informal adoptions. And we know that this problem is overwhelmingly affecting the children who live in these areas and these areas that are most affected. But we want to ask you if you're you know anything more about the 12-year-old Swedish boy who was thought to have been kidnapped from a hospital in Thailand by a European man. Is there any more news on him or any sense of how many of the children of tourists might be impacted by this?
No, I don't. But one thing as observation I can say is that it has helped to underline this issue. And I think it is important that child protection runs parallel with the actual ability of aid agencies to provide physical relief, that is, food, water, sanitation and medical care. Otherwise, what we do, the good work that all the aid agencies are doing, goes for naught.
John Budd of UNICEF speaking to us from Jakarta in Indonesia. And John, thank you so much for your time. I'm sorry we had a tough phone line and a tough topic, but we really appreciate your time on it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
. 2004 was quite a year for pop culture and the culture wars. Janet Jackson's wardrobe malfunction launched a year-long values debate that culminated in the presidential election. Gay marriage was in the headlines, but abysmal marriages were at the core of the wildly popular new television show Desperate Housewives, a primetime soap opera watched by almost as many viewers who tuned into the year-long trial of Scott Peterson, who was convicted of murdering his pregnant wife and unborn child. That trial increased sales of tabloid newspapers by 300,000 a paper and spiked TV ratings. At year's end, The Washington Post did a terrific report on the surprisingly high number of pregnant women who are violently killed, but no one paid much attention to that bigger picture. Meanwhile, what does 2005 hold? Well, Donald Trump of The Apprentice might be so 2004. Fox has a new reality show called Who's Your Daddy, in which adoptees try to guess their birth father for a $100,000 prize. Critics are having a field day. But recently, we sat down with Here Now's pop music critic Tim Riley, who says he's seeing some real advances in the music world.
We're undergoing a huge format change in the music industry, and it's even bigger than the last format change we went through with CDs, which was about 15 or 18 years ago. We're changing platforms, and the proof of that is that Apple sells iPods, those great little portable units with 20 and 40 gig hard drives, and the iTunes software that goes on the computer has a store attached to it, so you download CDs and you download one song at a time. This is transforming people's experience of music, and it represents a radical shift in the whole platform on which we're going to talk about music from here on out.
iPods. I mean, you could not find one at Christmas time. They were sold out. I was in a church just this past Sunday. The minister, you know, at the youth service, he gathered up the little kids and said, "Now, what was the gift of Christmas?" And the little boy said, "iPod." So, I mean, you don't mean to be blasphemous, but This is, especially for a younger generation, This is how they hear their music.
Yeah. Several things are going on here at once. One is it's an enormous shift, and in order to turn this cruise ship around, it's going to take a long time. And it's going to be a lot messier than it's even been. I don't think we've even begun to see a lot of the legal battles and a lot of the way that music is produced and then sold. I mean, the idea of a music retail store now is something that's going to be very, very different in the future than it was in the past. And this past year, it really went mainstream. Okay, last year, it was still more of a specialty item. This year, it's much more of a mainstream item. And it's becoming a verb. I iPodded this, you know, and you can get that on iPod. And you're tossing the brand name around as though the thing itself is, you know, the music player. But it's an iPod. It's like Kleenex, right? The brand name is synonymous with what it is now.
There's been another huge shift in the way we hear music and hear information. Satellite radio. This past year, XM and Sirius Radio. This past year, the $100 million contract for Howard Stern, who's going to Sirius Radio. We should toot our own horn a little bit and also divulge that this program is heard on XM Radio, mm-hmm. XM PR, Channel 133. People seem to be willing to buy in satellite radio what they could once get just by turning on the radio.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's several things going on here, too. One of the things is a huge shift in the way people are going to experience music. And the idea behind it, the marketing pitch behind it, is no ads, right? So what you're getting is digital streamed music from satellites, but you don't have to listen to ads in between set lists for what you're hearing. So people are willing to pay that money so they can bypass the ads.
Well, that's been a theory around here for a while now,
right.
We should also point out. But this is huge. Again, if you went into any of the stores, I was in a Best Buy. It was sort of an archaeological dig around Christmas. You could not get any of these XM radios. They were sold out.
Yeah, no, they have misjudged demand on this. They didn't expect to be expanding so quickly. And definitely the demand is definitely there now, people willing to pay that monthly fee to get that digital stream.
Let's skip over to television trends there. You and others have pointed to HBO still way out ahead in quality.
Well, I think HBO, in terms of creativity and being able to just go out there and market new product, they debuted a new serial last summer that was called Deadwood, which is about Wild Buffalo Bill's untimely demise in the Wild West. That's the series that I'm most anxious to see the new installment of this year on HBO.
Well, taking a look into the future in culture, Nexpert News is one of those resources on what's new and next, and they say a couple of things. One, two-minute reality TV shows. These are full reality shows, but they're going to run for 2 minutes as a series. Voice lifts for baby boomers that'll make their voices sound younger. Pan culture, more brown and beige than black and white. That's just some of the overarching cultural outlooks. But you specialize in the world of music. Tell us what you're looking forward to in the world of music.
Well, the big record that I'm waiting for is the new record from Beck, and that's coming up in early this year, 2005. Also new records from Frank Black of the Pixies, a solo record, Fiona Apple, which was delayed from supposed to be out last fall, and a big follow-up for Outkast, who had a big year 2 years ago, and they're going to have another big record called 10 the Hard Way. That's coming out in June.
Well, Tim, you've got to leave now. You've got a lot of work to do.
I know.
Here now is pop music critic Tim Riley. Tim, thank you.
Thank you.
When we come back, a New York Times movie critic says the low-budget but highly acclaimed 2004 film Sideways was vastly overrated. Well, Boston Globe critic Ty Burr put it on his top 10 list, and he'll tell us why. Also later, the latest from Baghdad. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, continuing our look at American pop culture as 1 year ends and another begins. The buddy film Sideways made more critics' top 10 lists than any other in 2004, and that includes Ty Burr's list. He's film critic for the Boston Globe, and he joins us with a look at what did and didn't make his list of best films in 2004, and also to give us a heads up what to look for in 2005. Hi, Ty.
Thanks, Robin.
And the first thing to note in your year-end article of the best films of 2004, The Passion of Christ and Fahrenheit 9/11 don't make the cut.
No.
Because why?
They were so much about arguing their own case that they fell down as films in very different ways, respectively.
They were preaching to the choir.
They're preaching to the choir. And in the case of Fahrenheit, fudging enough stuff to preach to that choir that I felt that they didn't need to when they could have made a perfectly good case without doing that. Passion of the Christ, well, you know, that movie doesn't need me as a booster. It's, what now, the eighth biggest moneymaker of all time, and And reached the people it was meant to reach, and you know, Mel Gibson made the movie he wanted to make.
I mean, and by the way, a better movie, you say, than many critics say.
A better made movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't speak to my, you know, spiritual beliefs, but it speaks to a lot of people's. And, you know, I give him credit for making the movie he wanted to make with his own money. And, you know, it reflects his beliefs, which aren't mine, but it got out there, and, you know, I give him credit for that.
As a film critic, what I found most interesting is that it didn't speak to you as a film goer, and so many other films did. Let's talk about some of those. What was the kind of movie that you liked this year?
Well, I liked the movies that sort of came out of nowhere and asked a bunch of interesting questions. First of all, Sideways was on the top of my list. And, you know, and that one, I got to say, it hits me in my sweet spot. I'm a mid-40s guy. It's a movie about mid-40s guys wrestling with their issues in a way that's extremely funny, extremely honest. And I think for a lot of audiences, I mean, so many people I've talked to are just happy to find a movie that's for them.
These girls want to party with us.
If they want to drink Merlot, we're drinking Merlot.
No, if anybody orders Merlot, I'm leaving. I am not drinking any Merlot!
As you said, you like small-scale films that turned away from the certainty of The Passion or Fahrenheit 9/11 and gave voice to personal doubts and hopes.
Right. Before Sunset's another example of that. I mean, that's, you know, a romance movie for people who don't mind 89 minutes of wall-to-wall talk. But it's in Paris, so that makes it a lot
that
easier.
That makes it easier to take. The Incredibles made your list, a film for kids and their dads, apparently, according to you.
Well, a film for kids and their dads and their moms.
It's a Pixar film. The Toy Story comes to mind in the genre. How is it different from other films of its genre for kids?
Well, for one thing, it's the first Pixar movie that you could say conforms to the auteur theory. The guy who made this movie, Brad Bird, he made one previous movie called The Iron Giant, which was an extremely underrated, very elegant, good animated movie back in like 1998, I think. And this has a lot of the same feel, a lot of the love of retro imagery, a lot of the same sort of unsettling doubts about adulthood and the world that get resolved in ways that aren't completely, you know, kid movie, let's just paper it all over and have a happy dance at the end.
Clint Eastwood came out of nowhere, at least for me, at the end of this year and made just about everybody's top 10 list.
It's a movie called Million Dollar Baby. I believe he finished filming it in August and then just sort of went away into the editing room, and it was on nobody's radar. And then all of a sudden people started seeing it. For my money, it is a richer, more powerful movie than anything he's done, and that includes Unforgiven and Mystic River. It's a boxing movie. He plays an old boxing manager. Hilary Swank plays this sort of trailer trash lady boxer, and you're already thinking this sounds like one of his old orangutan movies. It's not.
Mr. Dunn?
I owe you money.
No, sir.
I know your mama.
Thought you might be interested in training me.
I don't train girls.
People see me fat, say I'm pretty tough.
Girly, tough ain't enough.
On your list of runners-up, one of my favorite films, although I could barely watch it, Hotel Rwanda.
Mm-hmm.
You also have House of Flying Daggers, Vera Drake. Your worst list includes Christmas with the Cranks, Thank You.
You're welcome.
And I'm going to get mail on that one. And The Phantom of the Opera.
Oh, this was like having hot nails driven through my eyes. It was just, it was Joel Schumacher, the director, the guy who ruined the Batman franchise, bringing on Vogers, dancing dwarves. It is like the kitschiest night in Vegas, not even Vegas, in Atlantic City, that you've ever seen. When I wasn't laughing, I was in pain.
Your overarching sense of the movies of 2004?
The films in 2004 that caused the most controversy were ones that said they had all the answers. But the movies that I'm going to remember are the ones that asked the most interesting questions and didn't have all the answers.
Ty, before we let you go, look ahead. What films are on the horizon so that a Clint Eastwood doesn't blindside us again?
You know, it's so many sequels and remakes, some of which sound really good. I mean, for 2005, first of all, the third Star Wars 3, Revenge of the Sith, is coming out in May. And personally, I'm beyond caring at this point, but there are a lot of people for whom it matters very much. But there's some very interesting remakes. First of all, Nicole Kidman is starring in a remake in a big screen version of Bewitched with Shirley MacLaine in the old Agnes Moorehead role as Endora. Johnny Depp is playing Willy Wonka in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
No, why do that over again?
Have you seen the Gene Wilder one? That's a weird movie. I mean, Johnny Depp, sure, go ahead. And Tim Burton is directing it. But on the other hand, we've got Steve Martin playing Inspector Clouseau in a remake of The Pink Panther. There is going to be another Pixar movie, Cars. There's going to be another Harry Potter movie. Peter Jackson is coming back with King Kong, a remake of King Kong. Yes, this is like the fourth remake of King Kong. There's going to be a big screen version of The Chronicles of Narnia, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, at the end of the year. And I think one of the reasons this got the green light was because of the success of Passion of the Christ. I mean, if you've read the books, you know there's a lot of it's a Christian allegory. I mean, C.S. Lewis wrote it as a Christian allegory. Mm. And I don't know how far they're going to go with that, but I know that the movie started rolling once they saw that the Gibson movie was a success.
Well, it's a lovely book, so
yeah.
We'll see what
I
happens.
The only
movie
cast I know of is Tilda Swinton is playing the White Witch.
Ty Burr with a look back and ahead. Thank you so much, and I hope there are no phantoms in your future. Thank you, Ty.
Thank you.
And do I dream again? For now I'm gone.
Ty Burr is movie critic for the Boston Globe. You can send emails right to him. Tomorrow in Here and Now, lawmakers are geared up for a fight over granting legal status to illegal workers. Also, some accuse Iran of sending hundreds of thousands of Iranians to vote in the Iraqi election. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Sing once again with me, a strange duet, my power.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Washington, D.C. is preparing for a big, expensive party on January 20th when President Bush is inaugurated for the second time. Inaugurations during wartime are rare, and with the U.S. engaged in a worldwide war on terrorism, security in D.C. will be especially tight. James Barry is a retired Secret Service officer and former chief of the U.S. Capitol Police Force. He was involved in security planning for every inauguration between 1973 and 2001. He was also part of President Reagan's security detail on the day the president was shot in 1981. Well, recently, Here Now's Bob Oakes spoke with Barry about security planning for this year's inauguration.
Let me ask you, first of all, some of the stories that we've seen about preparations for this inaugural have called this, quote, a very, very serious event. That seems pretty obvious, but can you put it into context for us?
Well, in lieu of the 9/11 incident and what's happening worldwide in the terrorism arena, this has got to be one of the most significant security undertakings for the entire year.
Describe what security might be like.
Well, security is going to have an impact on people that are attending the inauguration. It's very evident. They'll see the evidence of security as they go to the mall and get off the subway system or public transportation system and attend the evening balls and the rallies during the course of the week. They'll be screened as they go onto the Capitol grounds to attend the event itself. People have to have tickets, and the tickets will prescribe the areas for their viewing and so forth. And everybody that, I guess, within the confines of the Capitol grounds will be screened. In previous inaugurations, we've never magnetometered or screened the people along the parade route, but this year we've kind of expanded the parameters for screening, and the parade route will have screening apparatus along the roadway.
If you're in the Washington area, do you think people would be reluctant to go because of the security concerns and security precautions?
I don't think that's the case. I think people here in the Washington area realize that the law enforcement elements, the U.S. Capitol Police, the Secret Service, you know, the FBI, the Metropolitan Police Department, and all the other police agencies involved are going to do the maximum to ensure that this is going to be the safest event that will occur. And I think that they'll be reassured that things will be safe and secure and won't impinge on them making that decision as to whether to go to the inauguration or whether to stay home. I think you'll see that there'll be a large attendance of people at the inauguration itself, and certainly at the evening events. I think that under the circumstances, if people couldn't find a place to be more secure and more at ease than at the inauguration itself.
You know, practically speaking, though, if you're a member of the public standing in a crowd somewhere on inauguration day, and you see something that might be suspicious to you, number one, I have to think you'd be reluctant to report it for fear of being thought of as stupid. But the second half is it might be tough to figure out how you get a hold of someone.
I would say to the contrary, by and large, from my experience, the people have taken an active role in trying to thwart something like that. I recall in the Reagan assassination attempt, we had a citizen in the crowd that observed Hinckley and sounded the alarm. We've had, I think, good record of people stepping up and doing the right thing under the circumstances. And I think under the circumstances here with this inauguration that, given the number of police officers that will be out there in uniform, both Capitol Police and Metropolitan Police, plus the other officers that they're bringing in from other jurisdictions, they'll be a great opportunity or plenty of opportunity to hail a police officer or make them aware of some extraordinary thing that may be occurring around them.
Most people will be watching this on TV, of course, not being able to be in Washington. Will it be noticeable from the TV vantage point, do you think?
To some extent it will. I don't think that they'll try to be as unobtrusive as possible, they mean the security agents in the police, so that they don't want this to be portrayed as an armed camp type of a venture. It's a people's event, as most of the politicians will tell you, and they want it portrayed in that fashion. But the security will be unobtrusive as possible, and you may see security people as the cameras pan the the crowds in some of the areas. But I don't think you're going to see the armoring of and the arming of people that you would see as if you're on a battlefront, so to speak. But it'll be there. There'll be a lot of it, but I don't think it's going to override the openness of the festivities, and certainly it's not going to create any air of tension.
Back in 1993, Bill Clinton, at his first inaugural, actually walked part of the parade route down Pennsylvania Avenue. Do you think that George Bush might take a little stroll this time around?
Hard to say. That's pretty much left up to the the president in consultation with the Secret Service, and I couldn't answer that question as to whether they'll do it again this year as they have done it in the past.
But I wouldn't be surprised if you told me that his security people, his security advisors, will be telling him not to do it.
Probably would be the case. I mean, oftentimes, you have to make the best of a situation when you're a security agent, and if the president says he's going to do it, then you've got to, so to speak, you have to shift and make appropriate preparations to deal with a situation where he would get out and walk. And in that case, you would make the appropriate adjustments to ensure that he can walk as safely as possible.
Can you do a little history for us, Mr. Verri? Compare security this time around to what it was like back in 1973 when you were involved your first time.
1973, I was a newly appointed Secret Service agent and was brought back to Washington, as probably 90% of the entire Secret Service was, to work the the Nixon inauguration. And back in those days, they just put us out along a parade route as opposed to observe people in the crowd and so forth. And we did the usual security parameters that were in place at that point in time. And back in those days, you didn't have to deal with the worldwide terrorism, so that wasn't taken into consideration as far as an inauguration of that time. And then I think probably when things started to change and security started to really ratchet up was right after the Reagan assassination attempt. And then I think we sat down and had to reassess our security posture and expand it and pump more money into security, bring more people into it. And then from that point on, every opportunity we had, we reassess our security preparations for the for large events such as an inauguration. And we continue to do that.
James Barry is a retired Secret Service officer and former chief of the U.S. Capitol Police Force. He spoke with Here Now's Bob Oakes. Still to come, author Cynthia Ozick. Her latest novel, Heir to the Glimmering World, is on many critics' top 10 lists of 2004. We'll hear why. You're listening to Here and Now. The governor of Baghdad province in Iraq was assassinated by gunmen today, less than a month before the country's first democratic elections in nearly 50 years. Also today, a suicide bomber detonated his truck near the Interior Ministry headquarters in the western part of Baghdad, killing at least 10. Meanwhile, five American soldiers were reported killed in two separate incidents in the country. Dan Murphy is covering Baghdad for the Christian Science Monitor. Dan, can you start by telling us more about today's assassination of the governor? Who is claiming responsibility?
Well, the Abu Musab Zarqawi's group run a few internet statements, and the veracity of them haven't been confirmed yet, is claiming responsibility. And so this is essentially al-Qaeda in Iraq that is taking responsibility. And, of course, they take responsibility for a great many things, and not all of them are things that they've done. But we have a intensifying sort of loosely affiliated insurgency here, and it seems a very fair bet that it's at least Sunni gunmen and probably people associated with his network.
And Zarqawi was recently endorsed by Osama bin Laden, we might note. Well, the governor had recently had survived a previous assassination attempt, correct?
He had indeed, I think multiple attempts, and his deputy was killed in the streets of Baghdad, 2 months ago now. And, it's only a matter of time before they start getting more and more of these people. We've had an incredible wave of suicide bombings unleashed in Iraq over the past couple of weeks or month, really since the major U.S. offensive in Fallujah. And if they let off 30 of them, every once in a while they're going to get somebody very senior.
Yeah, and what has been the impact? The fact that he is the governor, as you said, there have been so many Iraqi police killed in the last couple of weeks. But what are people saying about this most recent assassination?
Well, I think what it tells us is, he's sad to say, but he's replaceable. And, in a very real way, a guy like him is sort of constrained in what he could do anyways. This is, very much largely a U.S. operation still. However, it sends a very frightening message to all the sort of smaller fish that are participating with this transitional process, that if a guy this high profile in a place is nominally as secure as Baghdad can be gotten to, anybody could be gotten to. And so what we're worried about, or what we should worry about, is that we'll have more and more people afraid and unwilling to continue to cooperate.
Well, and this can't bode well for the upcoming January 30th elections. Are the candidates campaigning?
No, they're not campaigning. Not only are they not campaigning, but the vast majority of candidates' names remain secret. The lists with all of these names on them that are going to be published ahead of the election day at some point haven't been published yet. And so we have these big names for lists, but the actual entirety of the names there haven't been seen yet. And very few people are willing to go on television or to campaign in any open way for political office because they fear assassination.
Right. And leaders of the country's Sunni minority are now saying, well, they've been saying they're not going to participate in the elections, that the country's too unsafe. If that were to happen, first of all, would the elections be able to take place if the Sunnis withdrew? And if it does take place, what impact would that have?
I think that the elections can take place without them, but what you're looking at is a Shiite majority whose religious leadership, the Ayatollahs, have urged them to come out and vote, and they're eager to vote to sort of take power through the ballot box for the first time in Iraqi history. And they probably represent 60% of the population, are going to end up with maybe 70 or 80% of the seats in this assembly that's going to write a constitution. So that the Sunni community, by rejecting this vote out of either fear or dissatisfaction with the way it's being arranged, could end up completely marginalized, and you can have a situation where Shiites are writing a constitution that will then be injurious to Sunni interests, which then could lead to intensified and longer-running conflict between the two principal sects here in Iraq.
Dan Murphy, we only have a few seconds. In the wake of today's assassination and the bombings, again, probably just a yes or no, a chance of the elections being postponed?
A chance. Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani will have to agree to a postponement, and if he does, then it's possible, and he hasn't done that yet. Short of that, it won't happen.
Dan Murphy covers Baghdad for the Christian Science Monitor. He joined us from Baghdad. Dan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, updating our top story. Secretary of State Colin Powell, visiting Phuket, Thailand today, said more than 4,000 Americans are still unaccounted for following the Indian Ocean earthquake and tsunami. Powell, traveling with Florida Governor Jeb Bush, also said the U.S. may be able to do more to help identify the approximately 140,000 dead. Meanwhile, officials in Indonesia are confirming at least one case of attempted child kidnapping following the tsunami. In Jakarta, UNICEF spokesperson John Budd says child trafficking, already a problem in the region, is on the rise. He cites a text message a colleague of his received yesterday offering up children.
It says 300 orphans, age 3 to 10 years from Aceh for adoption. All paperwork will be taken care of, no fee. Please say age and sex of child required.
Bud says that a new UNICEF shelter for children and schools that should be reopening next month will help officials to try to stem child trafficking. Author Cynthia Ozick wrote a very witty piece in this past Sunday's New York Times Book Review about being on tour. For instance, she pointed out that one interviewer talked to her at length about Philip Roth's best-selling book. Well, at least when we had Cynthia on our program a few months ago, we stuck with hers. Heir to a Glimmering World is about a family of German refugees who've escaped Nazi-controlled Berlin by riding around in a rented limo, only to find themselves landing in upstate New York during the Depression. Into their life, Ozick introduces James, who as a child was the inspiration in a series of popular American children's books. He's still called the Bear Boy, and he becomes the German family's benefactor. Here's Cynthia reading from her book, where the two threads of the story first entwine, the Bear Boy seeing the refugees for the first time.
They were foreigners. Their speech was indistinct, Swedish or Norwegian or such. He would be interested if they were Swedish. They didn't look like Swedes. All the children were dark, and the mother could almost pass for a Jew. But what would Jews be doing here? He saw that the children were growing agitated, though their voices were still low. German. It was German he was hearing, and Germanic wails out of the baby, who wasn't actually a baby. It scampered away from the others, a tiny girl panicking. The older girl snatched the child up and led them all away. They were dressed oddly, the boys in short pants and high socks, the tall girl womanlike, dark hair wound in braids over her ears, jewels in the lobes. This shocked him. It was so foreign.
Author Cynthia Ozick reading from her novel Heir to the Glittering World, and she joins us from the Carnegie Hall Studios in New York to talk about it. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
It's a pleasure to talk to you after reading the book, which is just so, has, as some said, so many threads in it. You had a whole extra outfit there. Tell us about the family, the Mittwessers. Am I saying that right?
The Mittwesser family are refugees from Berlin, and they have fallen. In Berlin, they were a very high status. The father was a much revered and honored professor of an obscure 9th century religious heresy, and the mother was a physicist who worked at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute as a colleague of Erwin Schrödinger, who later won the Nobel Prize.
We get an idea of what's ahead in a backstory when you tell of how they escaped. They rented a limousine and kept continuously riding around.
Yes, they rode round and round in Berlin with an unfriendly driver who kept them locked in as he went up to reconnoiter their apartment and see what remained to be looted when he had delivered them to the ship in Hamburg. They were dependent on this driver, and they drove round and round for a week. And for ablutions, they walked through hotel lobbies to use the public facilities of hotels in great fear, hoping they would not be discovered.
Did people really ride around in limousines to escape the Nazis?
Well, this was told to me by such a person who, as a child, escaped with her family, and this is precisely a story that actually occurred.
Well, in addition to the family, we have the so-called Bear Boy. As a child, he was forced to be the inspiration for the central character in his father's world-famous children's books. As an adult, he supports the German family when he's not drunkenly trying to run away from his fame and the fortune it brought him. Why did you throw these people and so many others together?
Well, everybody in this story is a kind of refugee. The Bear Boy, as James the Bear comes to be known, is a refugee from his past. I based him on the real Christopher Robin and put him in an American setting, however. The real Christopher Robin, like my Bear Boy, became a kind of living shrine. The germ of this book was an obituary I found in the New York Times about the real Christopher Milne, who was living, he hoped, an obscure life in the north of England, running a little bookstore, seeking escape from the glimmering world that had been his past, and became deeply estranged from the father who dressed him up in short pants, high socks, and bangs and created Christopher Robin. So he's a refugee. Everyone here is a type of refugee, and all have lost or are estranged from or are angry with their patrimony.
That is what you wrote of and a little bit of why you wrote it. But I want to just take a second to talk about how you write the similes. A feeling falls over Rose like a fisherman's net when the door opens into the previously closed secretive study of Professor Mittwesser. You write, it's as if an eyelid had lifted. A gray sky is bitten into by zigzag lightning, like a sudden showing of teeth. Teeth come later, an egg is bitten, and it resembles, the little teeth marks that are left resemble a math formula of all things. How does that work? Do you see something and you say, that feels like something, I want to work that in to what I'm working on?
Well, that's a fascinating question, which requires lots of introspection. I think in writing a novel, there are several problems that one needs to be solved. You invent the problems and then you invent the solutions. One of the problems, of course, is the story and its sources. Another problem is language. And it seems to me that the vital life of the novel exists in the language. And you could have a wonderful story, but if it's told in inferior language, it hasn't got a chance. Think of the imagery in The Great Gatsby, the big advertising sign for eyeglasses, the last image that everyone remembers about the green light shining from the dock across the water. And novels are made up of their stories, their plots, and the images that both express and support the story.
Cynthia Ozick's book is called Heir to the Glimmering World. Cynthia, thank you.
Thank you.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again. Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.